And welcome to the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me is Anne Brennan from the Cape Cod Times. Hello, Anne.
Hello, John.
We're going to be rounding up the top local news stories of the week over the next hour. Tim Wood is going to join us. He's with the Cape Cod Chronicle. Jim Deruda of the New Bedford Standard Times will call in as well. We hear from Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer Mirror, Ed Miller of the Provincetown Banner, and Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Lots of news to talk about. The story that really grabbed me this week, Anne, was about the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station, and a report that's released that says there was a short period of time, I think it was in April, when that plant was running with no backup electricity generators.
Right. This was on April 11th. The workers at the plant had, there's two backup generators that in the case of the power plant losing power, these generators would kick in to make sure that the plant is running safely and could power pumps and
shut down,
you know, other things. And one of the two generators was taken down for routine maintenance about 7 p.m., I believe, on April 11th. And about 25 hours later, or more than 25 hours, that's what they're saying, a worker noticed that the backup generator was leaking water and then learned that it was not operational. So for some period of time, that generator was not working, and it wasn't until noon the next day that they were able to get that generator fixed and working. There was a corrosion issue in the piping with the generator that caused the outage. But the problem is nobody knows how long the plant was operating without the second backup generator. And there's, you know, safety concerns regarding that. As you might remember from Fukushima, it was the generators not working that led to all the problems there.
Right. They lost offsite power.
Right.
And then they didn't have their generators were flooded, so they weren't able to quick shut down the reactors.
Or to allow the pumps to continue pumping water through the spent fuel pools.
Right.
And that's when the water got to a dangerously low level in that plant. There were several that caused a meltdown and a huge release of radiation.
Yeah, they have to be in water, cooling in water.
Right.
And, of course, this Pilgrim, which is the same style of reactor as Fukushima, has lost off-site power in recent history.
Right.
And it was those backup generators that were relied upon to keep the plant running and to shut it down safely. So this is highly concerning, and it seems like there's still some more information they're trying to find out.
Right. Well, David Lockbaum, who is director of the Nuclear Safety Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, they're kind of like a watchdog for the nuclear power industry. He's asking questions about this. How long was it out? The two generators, were they out? And he's also questioning whether Entergy followed their processes, because they're saying that they always inspect when they're taking one generator out of commission from routine maintenance, mm-hmm. that they inspect the one that's the backup, the single one that's the backup. He's questioning whether that was done in this case. The generators are apparently checked twice a day. There's two 12-hour shifts, worker shifts, and each shift goes in and checks. It was during one of those checks that the leak was found. And for her part, Erin Carfang, the NRC's Nuclear Regulatory Commission senior resident inspector, said that the amount of water on the ground that was found would indicate to her that the generator had not been out for a quote-unquote extended time, because of the rate of water that was leaking. If it had been a long time, there would have been much more water. But they're still looking into this, and Lockbaum is looking for hoping to get some answers.
And the owner of the power plant, Entergy, has said that it will shut down by 2019, I believe. And that has opponents kind of concerned. Are they taking proper care? Are they doing the maintenance that is necessary to keep the plant safe in advance of that shutdown date?
Well, the plant is more than 40 years old, and Mary Lampert of Duxbury, who's one of the directors of Pilgrim Watch and has been an activist with this plant for years and years and years,
yeah.
She and Senator Dan Wolf have major concerns about this being an old plant with old equipment that is going to get worn out or break down, and that this is just another concern when you see corrosion like this shutting off a or putting out of service a backup generator. That's really important, keeping the plant safe.
Let's move on to another story. This one in today's paper about CVS Pharmacy. The corporation that runs CVS is being fined $3.5 million, and it all comes down to opiates, painkillers.
Right. So CVS was announced yesterday by U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz that CVS has agreed to a settlement of $3.5 million for filling forged prescriptions, mainly for painkillers. Opiate-based painkillers, and this involved more than 500 prescriptions that were filled between 2011 and 2014. This included more than 50 CVS stores in Boston and New Hampshire, but also on Cape Cod. CVS would not identify which stores were involved, but in announcing this yesterday, Ortiz did outline the case of a person, EM, which a source told us was Esperanza Mata of South Chatham, who is facing 13 grand jury indictments related to violations of the Controlled Substances Act. Mata is accused, who worked for a dentist,
right,
is accused of forging hundreds of prescriptions for hydrocodone using the dentist prescription name and address at 8 CVS stores between December 2012 and January 2014. That involved a store in South Dennis where 29 forged prescriptions were filled over 6 months for a total of 1,290 pills.
And the reason we're really talking about this is because the region, New England as a whole, but our region in particular, is going through an opiate crisis. And it's these pills, these painkillers that seem to be behind that as people starting off, whether recreationally or having been prescribed these drugs, they become hooked on them, dependent upon them. If they don't have them, they get withdrawals and they end up moving on to heroin. And that's really what's driving the increase in heroin use.
Because heroin is so much less expensive than the prescription medicines. But, you know, in one case, mm-hmm. She was able to fill 107 prescriptions using the dentist script pad that had a Massachusetts address, and at that point the dentist had closed her practice here in Massachusetts and had moved to Maine. So we really rely on pharmacists to make sure that these prescriptions are not forged. And so in addition to the $3.5 million settlement, there is an compliance agreement with the DEA that CVS maintain and enhance its programs that it's developed for detecting and preventing diversion of controlled substances.
It did seem to indicate in the story that this was something that the pharmacy could have been aware of.
Right.
Right. I mean, one phone call over to the dentist. Why are we seeing dozens and dozens of these prescriptions?
And I'm, you know, I don't know how these things work, but if a dentist is left and they're using the prescription and the dentist isn't even in practice in Massachusetts anymore, it would seem that there would be something.
Seems like
in
they're calling. Yeah, it seems like they're calling my kid's doctor every time I'm getting a vitamin. So
right.
I don't quite understand what happened, but it sounds like the feds are on this and this has been settled at least monetarily. Let's move on to this development, this workforce housing development, I think we could call it, in South Yarmouth. Tell us about this. Controversial.
It's controversial. This is a partnership between the town of Yarmouth and Dakota Partners Company for a proposed 120-unit affordable housing rental units. It would be 4 3-story buildings with 30 rental units of 1, 2, and 3-bedroom units on Route 28, where the former Cavalier Motel and the Bass River Motel are located. There's other hotels in the area, but along Route 28, but behind these this property is a neighborhood, and those neighbors came out to roundly condemn this plan, saying that using a lot of stereotypes, saying that low-income residents put a strain on police, fire, and schools, that it will increase traffic congestion, it will drive away tourism. One woman is saying that I'm going to have a three-story building, you know, 20 feet from my property line. And the vice president of Dakota Partners, Steve Kaminsky, said this is workforce housing, and these are for people who are working but aren't making enough to afford a place to live on Cape Cod, which has been a perennial problem. You know, we've been writing about this for decades. And the income limits for one bedroom, for example, is $32,200. Two bedroom is $46,000, and a three bedroom, $54,000 in income. So,
and so 100 out of the 120 units would be what is considered affordable. And you just laid out the numbers,
right?
The numbers there. And you're right. It's the lament. I mean, let's see what happens with the restaurants this summer
right.
in terms of do they have the workers they need. We know the sub shops are desperate for workers. I mean, that's not necessarily what we're talking about. We're talking about teachers and police officers
right.
that come in to start their careers. We know they're not staying. We know they're leaving. Young families are leaving this area, and prices are we can already see, going up.
Yes, and that is kind of the backbone of our community, like you say, teachers, firefighters, police officers, but also people who work in nursing homes.
Right.
And, you know, there's people who work in dentist's office. People, you know, there's a lot of services, plus the stores, retail, the people we need to keep our community going are just not making enough money to afford housing on Cape Cod. So, you know, the state standard for affordable housing in each town and city is that it be 10% of the housing stock be affordable. In Yarmouth, it's 4.4%. And town meeting last town meeting, they voted to spend community preservation funds as incentive money to get affordable housing projects built. So there's like this recognition that we really need this, but when the rubber hits the road, it's hard to get a project in place because
right.
of what people have in mind. And it does change their neighborhood. I mean, let's face it, it does.
This sounds like the type of project that all the studies kind of point to. You know, it's mixed use. It has $20,000 square feet of retail space. It's in an area where there is public transportation. It's not just a single family home on a 1 acre lot, which
right.
is what Cape Cod really traditionally has enjoyed. So this is a very interesting discussion because, as you say, it really speaks to what do we want, what do we need, but when the rubber hits the road, what can we really
right.
accomplish?
We can support it as long as it's not next door. and you know, I think that there's a long history of that in the world.
That's true. Let's take a quick break. Everybody calm down. Let's take a quick break. We're going to have Tim Wood join us. Tim Wood is with the Cape Cod Chronicle when we get back. Welcome back to the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Sean Corcoran. Anne Brennan is here from the Cape Cod Times. And for the past few weeks, we've been talking about what's going on over at the Cape Cod Community College, which is the only four-year institution here on Cape Cod besides the Maritime Academy. I guess the staff has been upset. There's been a vote of no confidence in the leadership there. There was a story in the Cape Cod Times this past weekend that kind of got to the bottom a little bit about how this is kind of built up over time, because that wasn't quite clear what was really behind this.
Right. This is the no confidence vote, a petition that was made advocating a no confidence vote for President John Cox that started percolating last January, but began circulating the petition in March. And we spoke with, or Jeff Splane spoke with Michael Betlick, who's the coordinator of the college's business administration program and co-author of the petition. And he explained the genesis of the controversy, saying that, you know, they had seen that people had been employees had been leaving the college recently, but it was only after Cindy Crossman, who was in the accounting office, after she left, that Betlick really took notice. And he said that he had taught Crossman in his graduate classes at UMass Dartmouth when she was getting her MBA. And he called her, she was just amazing in classes. And when she left, he said it was blatantly obvious that something terribly wrong had been done. And he started talking to, first they got a letter of support for Crossman that was signed by 50 staff and faculty members. But they also started talking to union representatives and others about what's been going on. And what they found were dozens of stories of employees who told of that they had been bullied, that they had been screamed at, and basically had been forced into resigning. This then spurred creation of the petition advocating a no-confidence vote for the president. There were people like Robin Dengler, a longtime mathematics professor who was on disability after having surgery, who said that she was getting people in the HR office were contacting her and saying that, she needed to get back to work, that the insurance was costing the college too much money. She said they called me a malingerer, a liar, a faker, an irresponsible person, and asked her why she couldn't find her own a way to pay for her own health insurance. Another person, Cheryl Rambert, said that after 21 years at Cape Cod Community College, she was bullied and forced into resigning in the position of accountant too, and described the harassment, which she claimed was harassment by her supervisor.
What are we hearing from the leadership? Are they responding to this?
So,
because they weren't.
Well, Cox said in an April meeting that more than three quarters of the college budget is made up of wages, salaries, and benefits, and that they are facing budget cuts and they have to make these cuts. And that while, it's sad to see your fellow employees leave, there's no other alternative. They can't get everything they need to cut in the other quarter of the budget. Well, that's what he's saying.
Sure. Well, but let's hope that this wasn't how they found ways
exactly.
to cut. I mean, you professionally, respectfully,
right.
Yes. dismiss someone because of budget cuts,
right.
drive them out.
Well, and Michael Gross, the spokesman of the college, said that five positions were eliminated for budgeting reasons and that those employees received state retirement benefits and a severance package. But there's been about 35 total employees who have left their jobs there. And it's not clear to me or to us whether they received similar termination packages, whether they retired or just left their job. There are two lawsuits in the process right now, and there's the Betlick says there's up to a minimum of four others pending, and that more than 35 other people are claiming mistreatment.
Well, I'm really eager to hear more from the leadership at the college because it seems so one-sided right now that I'd like to hear. There's got to be more
right.
to this story, and I'm certainly not from a lack of trying to get to the reporting. It's just people got to be willing to talk about it.
Right, and John Cox did say that he would add a faculty member to his advisory board and that he would try to be
more communicative
of
right.
what's going on, and we'll see what happens.
Okay, let's go to the phone. Tim Wood is standing by. Tim is with the Cape Cod Chronicle in Chatham. Hello, Tim.
Hi, Sean.
Good morning. I imagine Chatham is filled up with people already, huh?
It is getting quite crowded down here, yes.
Yeah, and a lot of them will be eating quahogs, and you have a story this week about a potential rule change coming regarding undersized quahogs.
Indeed. The State Division of Marine Fisheries is proposing to amend the state shellfish rules to allow the sale of undersized farm-raised quahogs in the state of Massachusetts. Now, this comes apparently at the request of the Massachusetts Aquaculture Association. And now the proposal has drawn opposition from our local commercial shell fishermen who harvest their catch from the wild. And this rule would only apply to aquaculture-raised shellfish, and the local shell fishermen would still have to maintain the 1-inch minimum size on quahogs. Now, these so-called petite quahogs go for a lower price than the 1-inch quahogs, and apparently they're used in a lot of pasta dishes and things like that. And local shellfishermen say opening up the market to these smaller shellfish could have enormous implications on the local wild shell fishery, which is huge in Chatham. Chatham last year harvested more than 21,000 bushels of quahogs, $1.4 million value. It's the largest wild quahog fishery on the Cape, and I think in the state. And that's nearly twice the amount of all the aquaculture-raised quahogs on the Cape last year combined. Now, the aquaculture companies are already allowed to sell the petite quahogs as well as oysters out of state, but shell fishermen say that if they're allowed to sell them in the state of Massachusetts, then potentially aquaculture growers from out of state will have access to that market now, the undersized market, and they will flood the market, and that will mean a drop in prices. Now, one option that was floated was to drop the legal size for wild-caught shellfish as well, quahogs, but officials say that could have a negative impact on the resource. What they're saying is the one-inch minimum size was set so that the wild quahogs could spawn a few times before they're harvested and thus maintain the resource. And they say that if you harvest them at the smaller size, there's no guarantee that that's going to happen. They say the science isn't there to prove that those smaller shellfish are also spawning. Mm-hmm. So this week, Chatham Shell Fishermen and the Board of Selectmen sent a letter to DMF Director David Pierce, opposing the rule change and asking for both an economic and biological study of this size reduction. Now, DMF has scheduled a hearing on this proposal here in Chatham on July 14th. Okay. But in the meantime, the Cape Cod Commercial Hook Fishermen's Alliance, which is a partial owner of ARC, the shellfish grower and dentist that supplies shellfish seed to many Cape towns, mm-hmm. Their membership also includes a lot of local wild shell fishermen as well. And they're trying to broker a compromise. They're meeting, they've set up a meeting in the next week with all the stakeholders involved to hopefully come up with some kind of way to resolve the situation and make everybody happy.
Real quick, any idea how this rule change was prompted?
Mr. Pierce said in Mr. Pierce said in a letter earlier this year that when the change was proposed, that this came to them from the Massachusetts Aquaculture Association, and they were looking to basically bolster the market, and also because they can sell these shellfish, these smaller shellfish out of state, they felt they should have access also to the local in-state market.
Okay. Tim Wood is the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thanks very much for that interesting story, Tim. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Sean.
Okay. Let's stay with the phone. Jim Deruda is joining us. He's the editorial page editor of the New Bedford Standard Times. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Sean.
Jim, the big news this week when it comes to transportation and the South Coast, not necessarily good news.
Yeah. I'm not sure if anybody's figured out whether it's good or bad.
Right.
South Coast Rail, as you know, this area lost commuter rail about 50 years ago when cars all took over the roads. But the last 20 years, people have been pushing pretty hard to get it back. And they went through a list of four different options, including like something from Attleboro coming through Attleboro, rejected because of too many rail crossings, and there were buses. The idea that they've settled on, the route they've settled on, is a Stoughton route, which, you know, goes west from Boston to Stoughton and then down toward Taunton to split for New Bedford and Fall River. The Army Corps of Engineers has already done their environmental impact statement, and it's all been okay. But the state, the current administration, has been working hard, obviously, on all MBTA issues. And not long ago, I guess they received an unsolicited proposal for a public-private partnership to expand the Southeast Expressway in Dorchester. And that changes the calculus for the fourth route that had been considered, which was to come straight down from South Station through Middleboro over the Lakeville commuter rail line.
Hmm.
By doing that, it opened up a lot of opportunities regarding land takings and regarding the necessity of parallel tracks over in that Middleboro route, and that also offered a much lower cost than what they had proposed for Stoughton, which previously was $2.2 billion, and now the Commonwealth says they think it's about 50% higher than that.
Wow.
And it, also, they think Stoughton, based on all the higher cost, couldn't be completed for an extra 7 years beyond what had been expected, going from 2022 to 2029. Hmm. So we've ended up with a state senator from Taunton, Mark Pacheco, who wants to see that Stoughton route pretty badly because Taunton's undergoing some revitalization downtown around a new courthouse, but they'll lose a station or two if the Middleborough route is taken. So they want that. Fall River, on the other hand, is struggling mightily with fiscal issues and trying to put things in order and making progress, according to what we see, but they want to see rail in Fall River as fast as possible, so now they're pushing for Middleborough, which leaves our delegation, this whole regional delegation, which has been so united on South Coast Rail, now perhaps at cross purposes over different routes again.
Wow. It's a complicated story. It's been going on for so long. I mean, every time there's an election, there politicians are coming down to the South Coast promising rail, and it's been going on for decades.
They are.
I know there's a lot of frustration in the region among people who want to have better access to the Boston area. Jim Deruda is with the New Bedford Standard Times. They're covering this story closely. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Sean.
Okay. And let's quickly move on to Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, who joins us. Hello, Josh.
Good morning.
Good morning. Let's see. You sent me some notes about 4th of July mania.
4th of July mania.
Sleeping
Nantucket
Island.
Again. Sleepy Island wakes up for 4th of July.
I guess.
The last 10 years or so, the island has been pretty much bursting at the seams on the holiday weekend anyway. But really what has townspeople, town fathers, and the police department, law enforcement concerned is a massive beach party on the South Shore, predominantly at Nobodyer Beach, where last year there was about 7,000 to 10,000 people, predominantly young people, many of them intoxicated, who trashed some dunes, spread a lot of garbage around, trespassed on private property. There were multiple arrests, hospitalizations for alcohol-related injuries, general bad behavior. And the Board of Selectmen for the last couple of years has talked among themselves and talked to the police department about basically shutting this party down and at the very least containing it and trying to stop some of this bad behavior. And this year they've taken more steps than ever before in an attempt to do that. The police department is bringing in dozens of officers from off-island, state and environmental police, Barnstable County Sheriff's officers. The Nantucket County Sheriff's Department is also going to be helping out in a number of ways. They are going to have officers stationed at multiple beaches doing ID checks. There will be checkpoints on beach intersections, not letting anybody down in vehicles other than residents in a number of places. They're going to be checking IDs, like I said, and making arrests if they have to. They've set up the high school as a detention facility for underage arrestees. The thing with underage arrestees in the state of Massachusetts is once they're processed, they cannot be released until they're picked up by their parents or a legal authorized guardian. And as the police department has said, a lot of these parents don't even know their kids are on Nantucket for the 4th of July holiday at this party. They told them they're going down to the Cape or going to a friend's, and they end up on Nantucket. So they're going to be sending officers over on the boat, and they'll also be stationed at a lot of the package stores as an attempt to deter underage purchase and the purchase of mass quantities of alcohol. So there seems to be a common thread here on the purchase and use of alcohol. It's one of the things they want to try and tamp down a little bit. They say they have no problem with responsible drink or responsible enjoyment of the holiday, but they're really concerned that this party, which has already gotten out of hand, fortunately, over the last 10 years or so, there have been no serious injuries and definitely, fortunately, no fatalities. But they are concerned that when you put that many people in one place with and you add alcohol into the mix, there is the potential for environmental damage, physical injury, and they really want to get a handle on that.
Holiday weekend, you're bringing over dozens of officers from the mainland. Anyone know what this is going to cost and who would bear the burden of that cost? The police department budget, overtime budget?
They've said that it is spread out largely. The state police is covering its own expenses to come over as part of their mission,
their
on the 4th of July, their duty for around the state. Police Chief Bill Pittman has said that because this is something that's happened for the last several years, at minimum, the police department has budgeted. He didn't give us an exact number, but there's going to be overtime. There's overtime on the 4th of July holiday anyway. Pretty much the entire 30-member Nantucket Police Force full-time, as well as the summer specials, all work 4th of July and day before, day after. There's no... no vacation time allowed, no days off. The only two people he said that won't be working are his two officers. They're off on medical leave on this holiday. So, a lot of expense. They do have it built into the budget, so it's not going to be an added expense. But, when you figure that 10,000 people on the beach at Nobadir and another, 10 to, probably more than, far more than that, 50,000 to 60,000 people coming to the island, mm-hmm. We're talking, this party, they say, needs to be controlled. But Nantucket is a very popular 4th of July destination that puts a lot of money into the businesses and the town, and certainly we rely on our summer business to keep us going through the fall and the winter. So, there is ways to pay for it and to prepare for it, and that's what they're looking to do now.
Okay, Josh, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks, Josh. Josh Balling of the Nantucket Enquirer-Mirror has a busy weekend ahead of him. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, and Ann Brennan is here from the Cape Cod Times. And let's talk quickly about these two stories, both related to a utility. Let's start with herbicides. The utility sprays herbicides under some power lines in order to keep them clear of growing plants and trees, and that's been controversial on the Cape for quite some time.
Right. The Board of Selectmen voted 3-1 this week to spend up to $15,000 on legal fees to challenge what is expected to be the approval of Eversource's 2016 annual operating plan. By state officials will look at that plan and they approve it. And within that plan is generally application of herbicides, like you said, on vegetation around
Right of ways, power lines,
and everything. The point is that they're saying that we can put this herbicide on and discourage the growth of tall growing plants, and then lower growing plants. It will encourage lower growing plants to move in and take over the area. But there's a lot of concern, especially on the part of the project. Protect Our Cape Cod Aquifer Group, which approached the Brewster Selectmen to ask for their support financially to fight legally if this plan is approved. And the Board of Selectmen also voted in favor of appointing a special counsel to represent the town on matters pertaining to the application of pesticides and or herbicides with this Eversource ruling.
A lot of people still have wells on Cape Cod.
Right. Well, the lion's share of the drinking water comes from the aquifer that flows under the ground all over Cape Cod, and keeping that pollution free is really important. And one selectman, James Foley, said that spending this $15,000 would be cheaper than cleaning up a polluted groundwater, which is the drinking water. That's the big concern. Mm-hmm. The chairman of the Board of Selectmen voted against this, saying that he's uncertain of whether they'd be successful in court in pushing this back. But the Brewster selectmen were approached first because they felt like this group, Protect Our Cape Cod Aquifer, felt they were most receptive. They plan to now go to Eastham, Orleans, Dennis, and Chatham and ask them for similar financial support to move forward.
Okay.
They've been applying herbicides since November 2013 after a hiatus that was voluntary, starting in 2009. Eversource, or the utility, stopped using herbicides beneath the power lines while working to answer concerns of the residents, but decided that the herbicides was the way to go, like I said, to prevent the growth of taller vegetation.
Okay, let's take a quick break. Ed Miller is standing by. Ed is with the Provincetown Banner. We'll get to Ed when we get back. Also, Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times, and Ann Brennan's going to stick around as well from the Cape Cod Times. Welcome back to the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me in the studio is Ann Brennan of the Cape Cod Times. Let's go quickly to the phone where Ed Miller is joining us from the Provincetown Banner. Hello, Ed.
Good morning, Sean. Happy Canadian Independence Day.
Oh, well, thank you for filling me in. I didn't realize that. Are you Canadian?
No, I'm not.
You just celebrated.
The editorial cartoonist in the Banner points out this week,
Yeah.
Given the way the presidential election is going, some of us may be singing "O Canada" at this time.
Maybe. Oh my! Okay, let's. We've been talking about, of course, the horrible Orlando nightclub shootings, and we were kind of talking about what maybe the reaction is in Provincetown. Any more about that in terms of security, safety concerns?
Yes, there is indeed. The shooting was now almost 3 weeks ago, but it's still very, very much on people's minds here with the busiest, most crowded time of the year now upon us. And it's clear that local law enforcement folks, along with state and federal authorities, have been talking about what should be done to increase security in places where large numbers of people gather. They're not really saying very much about exactly what it is that they're doing. They're just saying that actions are being taken, even though most of them will not be obvious. There will be a few more police on the street on bikes, but nothing really will change. There won't be checkpoints or anything like that. And it's clear from this past weekend, which was a huge one, it's the annual Portuguese Festival and Blessing of the Fleet in Provincetown, and the streets were crowded with people, as usual, and, you know, the bars and nightclubs are full. Nevertheless, people are concerned, and our reporter, Sophie Ruhr, went out and spent patrons and club owners and found an interesting diversity of reactions from people. Some older patrons of the clubs said, you know, yes, I'm concerned, but the feeling of being wary is really nothing new, because we remember times when gay clubs were being raided by the police, and
right.
We're used to that sense of you know, alertness. It's just that it's kind of reawakened a little bit of the old paranoia of the older generation. Younger partiers, on the other hand, say that it's kind of a new feeling, that, you know, they've grown up in a time that has been more open, and so the feeling of being unsafe is kind of a new thing. On the other hand, it's not really changing the way anybody is behaving. Seemingly, they're still coming to P-Town, even though they might stop and think twice about whether they want to do it. A group of people from Montreal said that they had been at a vigil after the Orlando events, and that people were very jumpy there when suddenly there were some loud noises and they started to freak out. Nevertheless, they said, we came to Provincetown, as one visitor put it, this is where I can be myself. Back home, it's not the same feeling. And right. Even if people are jumpier and a little more wary, this town is ours.
Oh, that's a very nice quote there, Ed. Ed, I know there is a story in the paper this week about residents at Province Landing. They're concerned, that's an affordable housing complex on Shank Painter Road in Provincetown. They're concerned that some folks have received some quit notices, and that could be the first step to being turned out of those homes. Could you encapsulate that pretty quick for us here?
Yes. So Province Landing is a 50-unit affordable housing development, as you said, on Shank Painter Road in Provincetown, a very important part of the community here for people who otherwise would not be able to afford to live here. And four families have been served with quit notices, which is the first step in the legal process of eviction, for not paying their rent on time or supposedly making too much noise. And a couple of the families came to complain to the Community Housing Board last Friday that they were not being treated fairly, that one woman said that she had been late with her rent a few times, but it was never more than 4 days, and that was no reason to be evicted. On the other hand, John Economos, who's the district manager for the Community Builders, which owns and manages the complex, says that this is really the last resort and that they send these notices out only to get people to come in and really seriously talk to them about dealing with issues. So
so it's not clear that they're going that this is leading to eviction.
It's not entirely clear. Economos says that he really hopes to avoid eviction and that it's quite rare. The Province Landing has been there for 5 years now, and he says there have been only 3 or 4 evictions.
Okay.
So some people do get evicted, and we'll keep watching that situation.
Thank you, Ed. Ed Miller of the Provincetown Banner. Hope you have a great weekend.
Thanks. Same to you, Sean.
Okay. Let's go to Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Nelson, I'm sorry to leave you on hold there so long.
That's all right. I get to hear what other people have to say.
I know, and they're all doing a great job. I appreciate it. You have a wonderful story in the paper this week about a Marine gunnery sergeant from Martha's Vineyard who received a medal for heroism in Afghanistan.
Yes. I thought this was just seemed so appropriate when it came over our desk for the 4th of July. It encapsulates so much about what's great about our country. Gunnery Sergeant Guillen Pereira, he came here with his family in 1995. They had moved from Brazil to New Jersey, and they moved to the vineyard in 95. He graduated from the Martha's Vineyard Regional High School in 2001 and then joined the Marines. He's been in the Marines for about 15 years. He's served in a number of hot spots, including Iraq and in Afghanistan. And in October 2015, he was in Afghanistan as part of something called Operation Freedom Sentinel. He was there helping to train Afghan security forces. And a helicopter crashed near his base. Two British troops were killed. A U.S. airman was killed. But there were a number of survivors, and he was one of the first on the scene. He helped to rescue people from the helicopter. And that's certainly at risk to his life because no one knew if the helicopter would explode. There was a lot of aviation fuel around. And last week, in a ceremony in Florida, he received the Navy and Marine Corps Medal. It's the service's highest non-combat decoration. His wife and daughter were there. And it's just a great story. And he's so, obviously his family's very proud of him. And he was very modest about his own actions, and he said other people were there helping. But obviously, his actions went above and beyond, or he would not have received a medal. And quite proud of him.
That was what really struck me the most in the story, was how humble he was and how willing he was to really point out that other people were coming too. I just happened to get there first. And I think we hear that a lot from the true heroes. They kind of downplay their own role in order to put the light on some of their comrades.
Well, I think part of it too, and he pointed this out, is just the sort of training he's had. He's trained to react, trained to take action, trained to go to the scene of the action, and in this case, he acquitted himself very well. The other thing I thought that was telling is he gave so much credit to his wife, and I've heard this before from career military people. He said, "Look, I wouldn't be able to do any of this without the support I get at home," and that's such an important part of these long deployments. So it was interesting to hear that as well.
Excellent point. Nelson, we're going to have to leave it at that. Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times. I know there are a lot of great stories in the paper this week, and people should pick it up. Thanks, Nelson.
You're welcome.
Okay, Ann Brennan is here from the Cape Cod Times, paper record here on Cape Cod. Ann, we've got a number of stories we're going to try to get to here. There's a sports complex potentially moving forward in Hyannis. Now, we've been talking about potential sports complexes at different places. This is one for Hyannis. We're talking about a $12 million facility, and looks like it could open fairly soon.
Right. They had a meeting. This is backed by Mike Sherman, former head coach and general manager of the Green Bay Packers, along with his business partner, Warren Nyhan.
So this is the coach, the NFL coach, who came to coach a high school team here in the Cape.
Right.
Amazing.
I want to say Nauset, right?
Right. I think you're right.
And they are proposing an adult and youth sports complex that would include 80,000 square foot main building with a National Hockey League size ice rink, indoor baseball, lacrosse grass fields. Then outside there would be a 60 by 100-yard lighted turf field for soccer and other and lacrosse, which would have a dome during the winter months. It's going to be in Independence Parkway on about 8.5 acres out there. And they met with the Barnstable folks, town officials, last week, and in the coming weeks they're going to be meeting with the Cape Cod Commission. At this point, Sherman says it looks like things are going very well in the permitting process, and if they do get the permits and things continue to proceed smoothly, they hope to break ground in November and be fully operational by the fall of 2017. Outdoor activities such as camps and clinics would begin as early as next summer.
And maybe I missed it. Whereabouts in Hyannis is this?
The Independence Park.
Where's that?
It's the if you're, it's across the street, like from the Cape Cod Mall area.
Oh, right.
It's,
okay.
It's up the street a little from the Cape Cod Mall, but it's on Route 132.
I gotcha.
And they're saying that there's just been an explosion in popularity in sports among adults and youth, and that people are having to go to, or teams having to travel to Bridgewater, Canton, and Kingston. So they think there's a market here, and also they want to host tournaments and other things that might bring money into the area for hotels and restaurants and other things.
I had the opportunity to be out in North Truro a few years back for a tour of the seashore, and I was amazed by this abandoned Air Force station out there. I mean, it's such prime real estate, and you've got all these crumbling buildings. Now, at least, it sounds like there's a plan for the property.
Well, it's known as the Highland Center, and it was designated for science, arts, and education initiatives back in 1998. And one of the obstacles to that happening is that a lot of the buildings have a lot of asbestos in them, so things haven't moved forward as had hoped. But now there's a new proposal that some of these buildings be used for housing, affordable housing. And the Provincetown and Truro selectmen are saying, well, let's look at this. Maybe the National Seashore got $1 million to demolish up to a dozen asbestos-sided buildings and pesticide-laden abandoned buildings there, which include dormitories and a heating plant and some single-family houses. Some of the selectmen are saying maybe this money could be spent differently to provide housing. We should talk about this. This has the support of Sarah Peake, and Congressman William Keating has been involved to a certain extent. But the National Seashore is saying that Seashore Advisory Commission Chairman Richard Delaney is saying that he's not commenting at this point, but he says one of the main obstacles to anything happening there has been this asbestos contamination. And if we eliminate that, then other things can come. So they're talking about this. It's a proposal on the table, and we'll see where it goes.
Okay. Let's jump back to a story that we didn't get to earlier that we plan to talk about. This one out of Orleans. It's really interesting. We only have about a minute left here, but there's a pond with some wires that go across. Some high tension wires, are they?
Yeah, this is Cedar Pond, and there are power lines nearby, and it's a favorite roosting spot for cormorants, which defecate, and the poop goes into the pond, and the increased nitrogen and, you know,
it just ruins
the water quality,
right?
of the pond, essentially.
You think they'd be able to kind of deal with their birds? You could scare them away, but this has been a real problem.
And it's been an ongoing problem to the point that the Town Conservation Commission in November ordered Eversource to the utility to file a notice of intent under the town's wetlands bylaw to bring its maintenance of power lines into compliance with the local bylaw. They've also the town officials are seeking special legislation to compel Eversource to abate what the town calls a public nuisance caused by the cormorants. Well, Eversource met with town officials on June 21st and presented five proposals of what they could do to mitigate this problem. The least expensive one, and it looks like maybe the most popular one, would cost about $900,000. They would move the power lines further away from to the south of the pond, and that would eliminate these cormorants sitting over the pond. There's Caroline Kennedy of Orleans and the Freshwater Quality Task Force is actually hoping that she can get, or asked Eversource to see whether they could actually move the lines all the way to Route 6. And and along Rock Harbor to get them even further away. But for their part, the Orleans officials are going to meet with consultants and other town officials to see if they can craft a response to these proposals.
Okay, we'll have to stand by to find out what happens with the birds. I want to thank Ann Brennan for coming in from the Cape Cod Times.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. And also Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jim DeRuda of the New Bedford Standard Times, Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Ed Miller of the Provincetown Banner, and Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thanks to all local journalists working hard to bring us news and information in the region. I'm Sean Corcoran of WCAI. Thank you for listening.